Horse meat's made it onto plates in schools, hospitals and pubs. The scandal has deepened today with News Burgers testing positive for horse DNA have been delivered to Brewers Fair and Premier Inn and hospitals in Northern Ireland. In Lancashire, County Council leader Jeff Driver admits it was in cottage pies served up at 47 schools.
It will have happened more than once. I think that's an inevitability, and of course we're really sorry that's happened, and we've done everything that we can about it. We've taken the initiative ourselves, tested our own product, we found it and we've withdrawn it.
Food Standards Agency inspectors have seized meat and computers at three more sites in Hull and North London. Coronation Street's Michael Lavelle says he's innocent of child sex offence charges and will fight them vigorously. The actor, who's played Kevin Webster for 30 years, has been suspended from the show. The family of Oscar Pistorius says he strongly disputes the charge that he murdered his girlfriend at his home in South Africa. The sprinter broke down in tears as the charge was read out in court. Around 1,000 people are now thought to have been hurt when a meteor hit the ground in Russia. It lit up the sky in the area around Chelyabinsk and caused a huge sonic blast that smashed windows for miles. Space journalist Kate Arkless-Gray says experts don't think it's connected to an asteroid that's due to skim past Earth this evening, closer than any other near miss on record.
This is big enough that it could level London or New York if it were to hit us, but it's going to be about 17,000 miles away, although that is very close in terms of the size of space, which is a very big place.
That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
BCFM 93.2, your Bristol station.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and this week, away from the white heat of Mayor Ferguson's budget and Bristol City Council's regime change, we go outside the castle walls this week. Helping us review this week's news is UKIP councillor for Bradley Stoke Town Council, Ben Walker. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, with Tory Work and Pension Secretary Ian Duncan-Smith's curious decision to make the disabled pay for the greed of the banksters, bullying and abuse of disabled people has reached miserable proportions. This week, some good news though, a disabled man who's made the authorities pay for treating him so badly. Plus, the marketisation of Bristol University as courses drift away from being designed for individual students and become more and more tailored to the wishes of rich corporations. We speak to one of the editors of the university's newspaper, Epigram. Big Brother and the drones, Trapwire, Riot, the technocrats' surveillance technology is arriving faster than you can blink and without public consent. So who watches the watchers? Steve Jolly is who, and he'll be bringing us up to date with the Orwellian state later in the show. Also, myths of the Israel-Palestine conflict. Did God give the Holy Land to Benjamin Netanyahu and the present state of Israel? Well, the son of an Israeli general begs to differ. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows of 1 degree Celsius tonight and dry. Highs tomorrow 9 Celsius, a sunny weekend, although slightly cloudier on Saturday. Next week, highs of 7 Celsius, a fairly sunny and dry week, but getting colder as the week progresses. Next weekend, the 23rd and 24th of February, highs back down to freezing and some sunshine, but also the possibility of snow next weekend. That's the 23rd and 24th of February. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is UKIP councillor on Bradley Stoke Town Council, that's Ben Walker. Hi Ben, welcome to Drive Time.
Thanks for having me.
Now Ben, you UKIP had a meeting, quite an important one in fact, on Tuesday in Bristol, and as I understand it, there's now a more formalised structure for the party across the whole of the city.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, locally, and when I say locally, I mean Bristol, South Gloss and obviously all the fringes, we are working really hard at establishing branches. And Bristol's been a difficult one for us for some time, but actually Monday, as you say, was a bit of a milestone, and we formed a really strong branch with a diverse membership, very young people as well. which I'm really pleased to report, and hopefully that'll help us drive forward here.
Now, give us just a background to how you joined UKIP, because weren't you originally elected as a Conservative councillor?
I was elected as a Conservative councillor on Bradley Stoke Town and South Gloucestershire Unitary Authority, and I defected to UKIP over a year ago now, I think.
Yeah, but why?
Oh, right, OK. I'm just trying to remember now. I just could not and did not agree with anything the party were doing. I couldn't agree with them on their massive changes to the NHS and basically all the backbiting, backstabbing and all that sort of stuff that goes on. I wanted no part of it, and it's rife within that party.
Okay, and you think that's just in where you are, Filton, Bradley Stoke area?
No, I think it's universal. I think you can tie them all with the same brush. I think it exists everywhere.
Okay, also, there's been one of the Conservative councillors on Bradley Stoke has left, I think.
This is just
in the post yesterday. Conservative mm-hmm. councillor for Bradley Stoke has resigned due to work commitments. And I'm always a little bit suspicious when they say that. But anyway, Keir Gravel's one of the four members representing Primrose Bridge Parish Ward. He's a naval architect, and he's been offered the chance to move. So is that right? Or do you think that maybe he's also maybe a little disillusioned with the Tory group there?
Well, I think you'd be absolutely right to say that. I mean, obviously, he has been given an opportunity of which he feels he can't pass up. And to be honest, at this current moment in time, I probably wouldn't either. But there you go. Actually, I don't think he's completely happy with the Conservative group, both in South Gloss and on Bradley Stoke. And it's a great shame, because actually Keir is a cracking guy, and he did it for all the right reasons. So it is a shame that he's gone.
So what are the big issues across the across that little part of the city? I mean, it's Filton, Bradley Stoke, South Gloucestershire. Quite clearly, Filton Airfield is quite a big one.
Yeah,
is it really that? Is it like beyond everything else? Is that what everybody's talking about and what many of these disputes are about?
There's a large percentage of people talking about the closure of Filton Airfield. I mean, you know, still now, the inspectorate has not made a decision on South Gloss's core strategy document. So the planning document, which kind of gives a green light for the developers to come in and put a planning app in on that site, yet they're taking equipment out of that airfield now, you know, lighting, all of that sort of stuff's being ripped out as we speak.
So, I'm imagining it's not all going to go back to cows and fields. I would have thought that the whole point of BAE Systems deciding to run the place down is so they can sell it on for quite a lot of money. But
absolutely.
Although, so they don't actually have planning permission for big housing estates on there.
No.
So haven't they kind of jumped the gun?
Pretty much, but I guess money talks, doesn't it? And they know that even by the actions they're taking now, that basically the local authority has no money and no will to challenge them. So they can pretty much get on and do what they want to.
So surely if people live around there, they've got no particular problem with more houses being built. Surely that means more infrastructure and a bigger community. In fact, more money being spent in the area.
Well, you would hope so. You really would hope so. But, you know, we're yet to see the detail on all of that. I mean, what we're looking at the moment, we're staring down the barrel of thousands of houses again. There's going to be no massive infrastructure changes either. And we've seen it before with the likes of Bradley Stoke, that they're not very good at planning all those infrastructure bits in, and they kind of come later after people have already bought their houses there.
So how long until South Gloucestershire Council do approve these housing or the infrastructure plan for these housing developments?
How long's a bit of string? I mean, it was supposed to happen twice already, so I'm not too sure. I think we are due a decision, I think they said March.
And so what sort of reasons are you and other people in the area giving to stop the building of houses on Filton Airfield?
Well, I think we're saturated already with housing there. That, you know, it's a massive problem. You know, we are a massive housing estate, and when you add us all together, it's huge. It really, really is. And like I say, the infrastructure is not there. When you look at the application that came in back in the early 90s to make Filton a commercial airport, you know, that's what they were talking about. Well, that was refused on the grounds of traffic, not noise, it was traffic. And yet we're happy to go and throw in a minimum of 3,500 houses on that site. And that kind of opens up the gate as well, because there's other bits of land attached to it. And I would put money on the fact that if that is sold off by BAE, within 3 to 5 years you will start to see a drop off of the industry that exists there. I now, guarantee that.
I've been up past the A38, past the end of the old runway at Filton, and the Royal Mail. One wonders where, you know, if the whole point of it being there was so that they could bring aircraft in and out to bring them to take the mail around the country and possibly abroad, that sort of thing. So it seems a bit strange to shut the airfield. It's almost like they've been abandoned, as the aviation companies have, by the closure of the airfield. But there are already houses going up.
That's true, yeah, on the fringe, you know, on the bits of land that they've kind of really close, and they've managed to do that, they've done it, and they're all, you know, they're already kind of predetermining the decision there. I mean, it's really bad because, you know, the likes of BAE, they're already putting up the rents, the ground rents to, you know, the Airbus and the likes that sort of rent that site from them. They knew they were doing this years ago. At the end of the day, this is a company that isn't a company that resides in this country, and they just see that as an asset.
BAE? I mean, BAE is a British company, surely.
Well, I'd say it was more European, but there you go.
Okay, now, you aren't the only UK Independence Party councillor of Bradley Stoke. Just give us a little bit of the history of how there's been this sort of slow migration of people from, and individuals from the Conservative group over to UKIP.
I think that, I mean, the great thing about UKIP, and obviously there's lots of fallacies that exist about the party, but it is a free-thinking, free-speaking party. You know, they are classical libertarians. They're not these right-wing nut jobs that people like to paint the picture of us. That's not the case at all, you know. We are people that feel very, very strongly about our rights as a country, you know, being able to govern yourself, and determining your own future, not being governed by somebody else. And actually, you know, all the things that kind of an old school Tory party probably believed in. And I think lots of grassroots Conservatives at the moment believe that they're not being listened to, and they're just kind of this tool of war that's used by, you know, the London-based party to sort of carry out their will, really.
But are you not, I mean, as UKIP, surely not a closet racist party? There's a lot of people who are annoyed about immigration, and for all sorts of different reasons. Some of those may be racist. They can join UKIP if they want, can't they?
Well, no, they can't, because we are the only party who will not allow any members to join if they've had any dealings with any sort of radical racist party in the past. That we're the only party to do that, and none of the others do. The big three don't do it.
Okay, now, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is with us too. Martin, we picked up last week on the volunteer appointment to George Ferguson's cabinet of this chap from KPMG, really just reiterating that, I suppose. This is an article from January from Reuters saying the UK audit market probes findings have been delayed again. Britain's antitrust watchdog has delayed for a second time the findings of a probe into the grip exercised by the Big Four accounting firms on the audit market. The keenly anticipated provisional findings are now due out mid-February. Well, that should be any time now. We still haven't had them. 3 months after the previous deadline of last November, which had already been extended once. The competition's... I mean, you can't make this stuff up, can you? They've already extended the deadline twice now, and yet we're supposed to be having them any time now. KPMG, UL, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Deloitte, and Ernst & Young are the three big guys, and they're having a... Basically, what's happening is an audit of the auditors.
Well, that's right. And I think, of course, what we're looking at here is the tip of a very big iceberg. The whole financial system is riddled with fraud from top to bottom. The auditors are just part of it. And, of course, it's very difficult even for governments that want to do something about it to tackle it, because the financial system is so fragile that if you started to look into what was been going on, like the LIBOR fixing and so on, properly, then you're actually going to precipitate a crash. But, of course, a crash may happen anyway because it's rotten through and through.
I mean, are you saying that for some of the big financial institutions, the FTSE 100 companies, they're saying if you dare to come in here and look at our books, we may just collapse, so stay away?
Well, we're talking about the fire insurance and real estate sector, the fire sector. I mean, there's plenty of good companies operating out there, you know, doing things that they've always done, but the financial services industry in this country, which has been treated as a cash cow in some respects, is in fact a massive Trojan horse, because for example, if the US municipalities start to sue our big banks for fixing the LIBOR rate, and they've got good lawyers, those people, and they've lost millions, and they're cutting their frontline services in Detroit, and they're not happy about that. And ultimately, The real problem is that the system is riddled with fraud from top to bottom. But it's not just a few bad apples.
But these four businesses, Reuters are saying, do the books for Britain's top 350 companies. Only four. It's not doesn't really sound like proper competition. The other thing about companies like KPMG, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Deloitte and Ernst & Young is many of them signed off accounts of some of the banks pre-2008. So there's questions surely about who are these people and can we trust them?
Well, I think that's right. And the other major flaw in the system is that companies buy in their auditors and they pay for them. So it's not independent. I mean, you're not going to get much work if you really start ferreting around. This is what came out with Andersons and Enron, for example. And of course, the thing is, once companies get the habit of fiddling the books, they then undermine their competitors. So the system as a whole becomes corrupted as long as people get away with it. And during the savings and loan crisis in the 1980s in the US, up to 1,000, I mean, the regulatory system was still relatively robust then, up to 1,000 top executives were sent to prison. Now, this time, despite the fraud being much bigger on both sides of the Atlantic, it still slaps on the wrist time.
Some of the officials from these big four accounting firms say privately that the Commission may be finding it difficult to come up with workable reforms despite pressure to act. So they're basically scratching their heads thinking, what do we do about this? They're not disputing that there are problems. They just haven't got a clue, it seems, what to do about it. And politicians have criticised these accounting firms for being too close to banking clients in particular, giving them clean bills of health, as I said just now. Just before, the taxpayers had to rescue several lenders in the financial crisis of 2007 through 2009. The four who checked the books of nearly all the world's biggest companies. So there's enough competition to point to downward pressure on fees.
Yeah, well, it's not just a question of competition. I mean, this is a delusion. You could have more competition, and if you still, what you could then have is companies saying, look, if we'll give you a clean bill of health cheaper than they will, because it's all bought by the companies concerned. What you really need is independent regulation, but of course independent regulation of the financial sector could lead basically to it being completely different setup.
I suppose the obvious question here, I mean, we'll be talking about who watches the watchers later, yeah, at CCTV, is who audits the auditors?
Well, you don't put foxes in charge of hen houses, do you?
Okay, Marty, I think that's very much to the point. Anyway, the big story, I suppose, of the week, the last few weeks, of course, is the rise in prominence of a certain Owen Paterson. I didn't heard really much about this agriculture secretary until the meat horse scandal. Well, let's have a listen to him earlier on this week in the House of Commons.
Consortium, Food and Drink Federation, British Meat Processors Association, the Federation of Wholesale Distributors, the Institute of Grocery Distribution and individual retailers, I made clear I expected to see the following from them. Meaningful results from this testing by the end of this week. More testing of products for horse along the supply chain, and that the industry must cooperate fully with the FSA on this. Publication of industry test results every 3 months through the FSA, and that they let the FSA know as soon as they become aware of a potential problem in their products. I made it very clear that there needs to be openness and transparency in the system for the benefit of consumers. Retailers and processors need to deliver on these commitments to reassure their customers.
Okay, right, well, basically, I mean, I've got some, it was on the news this morning, but in my ward, in Bradley State North, there is a company called Greencore, who have just been found of having supplying horse meat in some of their products. I can't say which ones, because I'm not sure. But basically, yeah, you know, local company, Bradley Stoke, and they're tarred with this brush as well now. So they've been up to it too.
So they're not actually slaughtering animals there. They are just
processing.
I mean, you know, this seems a bit silly, doesn't it, to have a chain of so many different companies. One passes it on to the other and on to the other and on to the other. Much of it may be frozen and processed and then sort of parceled up. It seems that there's got to be some better way of doing this. What's your thoughts on this whole business, Ben?
Well, I mean, I think I was just talking to Martin, actually. We're scratching the surface at the moment. I think this has been going on for a far longer time than we know of, and it's probably much more widespread than we currently know of as well. And I think, you know, the moral of the story is buy local, I guess. At least you know where it's coming from, because at the moment, you know, like you say, you have no knowledge of where the produce is coming from, and in fact now, even what it is and what's in it. It's incredible.
Owen Paterson there is blaming fairly and squarely. He's blaming the industry. He's blaming the supermarkets, the retailers, and he's blaming the people who are actually processing and moving this meat around. Do you think he's right to do that?
Well, I think obviously they have a massive part to play in this. Of course they do. But again, you know, when we go back to the item previous to this, but when you talk about regulation, well, the FSA have no teeth. There's nothing they can do. Owen Paterson was asking for a voluntary kind of inspection by people who produce this stuff. You know, that's not really very good, is it? You know, the government can't come down on these people. I mean, what's going on?
And much of this seems to be the finger of blame is being pointed, waved around Europe, various different countries, Romania, yep. Poland, etc. It finally seems to be kind of coming to rest with a big finger pointing at France, doesn't
yep.
it? I mean, this almost seems like a gift to UKIP, really, you know. So what from your knowledge of how the EU works, is the EU actually really responsible here, or is it just irresponsible importers bringing it into Britain?
I think it's irresponsible importers. Yeah, of course the EU has its part to play. The trouble is, when you look and you go back to when our meats were sort of banned and France banned them, well, the truth is, France couldn't do that. I mean, at this moment in time, we can't even ban this stuff coming in. We're not allowed. The EU prevents us from doing that, you know, and again, it goes back to my point earlier, we can't govern ourselves. So I think, you know, the EU could maybe think about, again, how they, you know, implement rules and when situations like this occur. But, yeah, I mean, it's shocking. It's absolutely shocking. And I think it is unfair to sort of put the blame on one country or one system or whatever. I mean, it is much bigger than this. And it's a root and branch sort of think about and look at.
But it's not really fair for you to say that the FSA can't do anything, that government really can't do anything, because these people, they're breaking the law of food labelling, if nothing else, by passing something off of trading standards, yep. all sorts of things. What they're doing is they're presenting one thing as another thing and selling it. So surely they're breaking the law at that point, at which case, you know, that's a crime.
And it absolutely is a crime, but that is the only thing that the government have to sort of pin their mast to or their flag. There's nothing else, really. The FSA should be able to go in, do inspections off the cuff. As and when they want to do them, they can just turn up, do an inspection, and they can actually, you know, pass judgment and implement fines, charges, whatever it be, I don't know, but you know, be able to do something. But they can't do anything. It's all voluntary from the industry, and that's horrendous.
Martin, this has been going on for a few weeks now. What are your thoughts about the actual root causes of it in politics or economics, or why these crimes that have been being committed here, whether they're cross-border crimes, crimes in Romania, crimes in France, or crimes in Britain, have simply not been tackled at any point over the last, 4 or 5 years, however long this has been going on for?
Well, it's to do with vested interests and lobbying and so on. I mean, it reminds me, in the early part of the 19th century, there's a book called The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, who was a Chicago journalist, and is exposing the meat production in the Chicago meat factories. And of course, those meat factories, with all of the trains coming in from the Midwest, were the beginnings of production lines and so on. So they're very important in the history of industry. And of course, the sausages, you know, you don't want to see how sausages are made. I mean, most people who eat sausages wouldn't like to see how sausages are made.
Sausage.
Well, I do as well. But the thing is, I mean, the fact is, actually, what we're doing here is this whole idea of cheap food for low-income people. And I don't think, as I said last week, Tony, you shouldn't be able to buy a £1.50 chicken.
No.
There should be an absolute standard that we're expecting, and that means that you've got to do things like raise people's benefits and so on, so that they don't have to go to Iceland to buy horse meat pretending to be beef. Because, of course, that's who's really... who ends up eating this stuff.
That's absolutely right.
It's the people at the bottom. It's the people at the bottom who've got, you know, four kids to feed on a budget.
I noticed Tracy Worcester, who wrote, did a film called Pig Business, which was all about the standards of food across Europe. I mean, essentially, what's going on, and I'll ask you both of this, it seems to me, Martin, you first, is that there's the lowest common denominator. If the supermarkets can get away with selling cheap horse meat as anything, when putting a label on it, making it look nice, they will do, won't they? And if they get away with that for years and years and years, and of course, they're going to benefit massively through extra profits, aren't they?
Well, they are. So, but the EU, in principle, because of the common agricultural policy, if it wasn't abolished but reformed, I remember talking to French farmers about this a long time ago, and they were small farmers, and they're saying what we need is a subsidy per working farmer. not subsidy for production, for things that nobody wants. And in other words, if we do want to keep the diversity of European agriculture, and we do, I mean, I used to live in Poland, and there's lots of very small farmers there who are being driven out by, and it's not fair competition, you know, it's dumped from the outside because it's all subsidised. International food markets are rigged. That's why the Common Agricultural Policy exists. It's why Britain, when it wasn't in the Common Agricultural Policy, had its own agricultural policy. Because otherwise, why would you, you know, we might as well buy all our food from outside and have done with it, which has always been a kind of policy in Britain. From New Zealand, the Dunedin arrived in London in 1888 with refrigerated lamb cheaper than from Wales, then the writing was on the wall for free market farming in Britain. But I don't believe in free markets. I believe in managed markets. So we decide what we want to do. We want local production by small farmers, and let's just rig it to do that. That's what I would suggest.
Ben, what about this point that actually the supermarkets, whoever has started this amongst the supermarkets, has made a fortune, and everyone else has looked at them and said, well, they're getting away with it, so can we? A little bit what's been going on in the city.
It's almost a carbon copy, isn't it? You know, just with a different product, I guess. I mean, it is amazing that this has been going on, probably still is going on, and we can't locate it, we can't stop it. But Martin's right to say that if you've got supermarkets that are selling stuff for next to nothing, you have got to question what the hell they're putting in that stuff. You know, because at the end of the day, supermarkets aren't doing it for fun, they're doing it to make money.
Also, I mean, in a way, this is a kind of pat on the back for the animal rights people. They're saying, look, I mean, the conditions, the secrecy of the abattoirs really don't lead to good food production, as you were saying. What are your thoughts about that, Ben? Because at the end of the day, it's a nasty business, isn't it, the meat industry? And there isn't really very much scrutiny. Occasionally, someone will go in, maybe with a hidden camera, and find out what's going on inside a slaughterhouse. But really, it's a kind of brick wall around that place.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, I'm not a massive believer in sort of forced state regulation of everything. I mean, obviously, I would be opposed to lots of stuff like that, you know. But it's about morals with people, isn't it? And it just seems to me that...
But this is about money. I mean, the morals don't come into it, do they, really?
No, they don't. And that is the trouble. I mean, it seems with everything at the moment these days, it's all governed by greed. You know, it's all about making money. Irrespective of what the...
You almost argued yourself against yourself there. Because one point you're saying, you know, oh, there shouldn't be so much regulation. But on the other hand, is if you don't regulate, people just are greedy.
Yeah.
I think the key is to have the correct regulation.
That's right.
It's like changing the rules of rugby union in the 1980s to make it a better game, a faster game. And of course, without rules, you haven't got a game.
No.
You've got a free-for-all. And all markets require regulation. The question is, what regulation, and get it right?
That's right. I mean, because I am not against regulation in any way, shape or form, but you're right, it's got to be the right regulation.
Without regulation, you haven't got a market, have you? You've just got a mess.
OK, on to Prime Minister's questions now. Martin's favourite bit of the show. And we have Stephen Williams asking a question this week of David Cameron about disclosure of tax by big corporations. So let's go to Wednesday, the House of Commons, and Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams.
Mr. Stephen Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On Saturday, I spoke at an event in my constituency organised by Christian Aid and hosted by the Woodlands Church in Clifton on tax avoidance in developing countries. Would the Prime Minister agree with me that we could do much to combat this problem by assisting developing countries to develop their own tax collection and assessment capabilities, but also requiring British companies to be completely transparent about profits made and taxes paid in each country of operation?
Now, and I think my honourable friend makes a very important point. I think there are huge amounts of things we can do here. The work we've done with some less developed countries has actually seen their tax base sometimes as much as treble. And we need to do far more in all these countries because it's an absolutely vital part of development. The issue he raises with respect to tax transparency, I also agree with, and that's why this government is putting it at the head of our G8 agenda for the G8 meeting that will take place in June at Loch Earn in Northern Ireland. I think one of the great things about this agenda is it brings together both developing and developed countries with a shared agenda.
That was Stephen Williams' question to Prime Minister David Cameron, rather cut off at the end there because the Speaker interrupted him. Anyway, Martin, this is the first I've heard that many of these developing world countries, for example, African countries, don't have their own tax collection capability. They have to actually bring it in from outside. And Christian Aid is now saying that there really must be complete independence for these countries to be able to collect tax within their own countries, because they're finding it almost impossible to get tax off Western, big Western firms that operate within countries right across Africa and other parts of the developing world.
Yes, and in fact, it's basically a lot of what the City of London has been involved in all these years. I mean, it's quite interesting. There was not the usual bear pit atmosphere around us in the House of Commons.
Oh, so you liked that one, did you?
Well, that was one of those. That was okay. Exchange. Because, of course, in actual fact, nobody dares to suggest that it's anything other than unacceptable for people to avoid their taxes. But, of course, hypocrisy...
Well, apart from the Prime Minister's father, who developed an entire world of tax avoidance over in Panama.
Indeed, and what does the City of London do apart from... facilitate the Cayman Islands and Jersey and so on. But hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. So we're all in favour of virtue now. Everybody should pay their taxes, just not me. Somebody else.
Okay, Ben. What about the bigger picture here with companies that are operating abroad, but not actually not paying tax abroad? I mean, many of these companies, we're not even getting the tax paid here. They move their tax liabilities, don't they, around to somewhere like Luxembourg or Andorra or some other silly country somewhere else that hasn't actually hardly takes any tax off them at all.
No, and it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. I mean, you know, we all want companies to grow and to employ people and to be based in our own backyard. You know, that's true. But I would say, my personal view would be, if you are a company here and you operate here, pay your taxes or get out.
Well, they're going to move their headquarters if you say that, aren't they? That's the first thing they're going to do.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm speaking from my personal view. My personal view would be, if you don't want to invest, just get out.
Yeah, you're on Team Britain or you're not.
Okay, but isn't that simply, like I say, Martin, going to mean that all of these big firms, they'll be off to France, they'll be off to Luxembourg, they'll be off somewhere else?
There's been a very interesting proposal, I'm not quite sure what's happened about it, which is, if you are evading tax as assessed by the British tax authorities, then basically you can't have any contracts from the British government, and the EU could do the same. I mean, we've got, eventually the political will to deal with this problem will emerge when the crisis gets bad enough.
Yeah.
And you can see even a Conservative government, which is determined on what I think is the wrong macroeconomic policy, they need the money, and they're starting to think, hang on a minute, we need this money for the things we need to do. And ultimately, that will have to happen. I mean, it was a more controlled society in the 1950s. It's more difficult to do today than it was then. Mm. But the idea that it's impossible, it's a political will that's required.
Okay, that's right. Yeah. Back to Prime Minister's questions then. And this time it's police numbers. And Gareth Williams is the questioner.
According to a Freedom of Information answer, there were 4,000 fewer uniformed police officers on London streets after the Prime Minister's first 2 years in office, with the percentage of crimes being solved in London down as well. Why has the Prime Minister broken his promise to protect frontline policing?
Well, first of all, crime is down by 10%, not just generally, but actually specifically in the Honourable Member's area, in the Harrow Community Safety Partnership area. That's a much greater reduction than for the whole of the Metropolitan Police area. The number of neighbourhood police officers is actually up since the election, from 895 to 3,418, and there are many fewer officers in back office jobs. In 2010, there were 1,346 of them. That is now less than 1,000. So I think on all this, what we've seen is a reform agenda for the police. Yes, there have been spending reductions, but crime is down and visible policing is up.
Yes, actually that was Gareth Thomas there, not Gareth Williams, answering that question about police numbers. Thousands, Martin, of less police on the streets, and yet, I think is it 3,000, and yet Prime Minister saying crime has gone down 10%. It all sounds quite good, actually. Maybe we should get rid of more police and crime would go down further.
Well, I mean, as you know, we've had representatives of the Police Federation on this programme in previous weeks, and they wouldn't recognise what's being said there, basically.
And they're
the ones who... I mean, they are a producer interest, if you like, but they feel quite strongly that they're not being supported by the current coalition government, and they're pretty strong in saying so.
Oh, and we will have the result of their ballot on whether to change their constitution to allow the police to go on strike at the end of next month. Ben, what are your thoughts about that? What's your feeling about what's going on with the police? We hear thousands less on the beat, but crime is going down.
Well, I think crime may well be going down when you look at the stat, as an overall, but the fact is, I think there's crime that's not being reported now. Mm. I think there's a high percentage of that that's going on. And the fact is, what I cannot understand for the life of me is why this Tory government are just hell-bent on introducing an American system of policing over here. I mean, we have commissioners. Now they want to open up lots of sort of jobs to foreign people to come over here and sort of govern our police and sort of, you know, in management roles. They're cutting the police right back. I mean, I've heard talk about implementing like a sheriff as such. I mean, soon it'll just be money talks, you know. You can get off with a crime if you've got the money to pay. And it seems that's the way we're going. And I cannot understand, like I say, why these Conservatives are just so interested in basing our system on like an American one, which I'm not so sure works well. But there you go. That's just my thoughts.
Okay, staying again with Prime Minister's questions, last one this time. This is Stephen Powell. He's asking the Prime Minister, did he benefit directly from his own tax changes?
Stephen Pound.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Further to the rather acerbic exchange with the Leader of the Opposition earlier on, can I ask the Prime Minister if he will tell the House whether he will personally benefit from the millionaire's tax cut to be introduced this April?
I will pay all the taxes that are due in the proper way. But the point I'd make to him is that all the years he sat on this side of the House, there was a top rate of tax that was lower than the one we're putting in place. And I didn't hear any groaning from him then.
Well, I think actually all that was really required there was a yes or no answer. It doesn't seem that the Speaker really presses the Prime Minister very hard to get an answer to these questions. And so one wonders, what is the point? In fact, Martin, I'm coming around to your point of view as to the how much there is a point in question time or not when you don't actually get an answer. But Ben, it's pretty clear the Prime Minister is personally going to benefit from the millionaire's tax break. And why shouldn't he? I mean, he's in charge.
Well... I think we might as well just call it a dictatorship then, haven't we, in the end, really, if that's what he's going to end up doing. You know, I think there's so many millionaires in Westminster now that it's not representative of the population of this country, and I feel that we really need to turf all these guys out and get some proper representation.
But I mean, isn't there an inevitability that the rich and powerful will gravitate towards those positions of power and then use them to feather their own nest?
I think that's absolutely true, and Martin again sort of mentioned stuff like this earlier, and it's rife, you know. It's been the system in this country for years now. How we get rid of it, I really don't know, but there is no way on earth that all those guys who are millionaires in Westminster aren't going to benefit. Of course.
Well, democracy is a word, is a Greek word. It means the people rule. Clearly, the people aren't ruling in our democracy. Martin, how about any suggestions for change? Do you think it really is going to have to be some kind of big national crisis before there will be any change? Or can there be change through the democratic system, through the ballot box?
Well, I hope it will come through the democratic system and through the ballot box. But at the moment, we're in a position of stasis. I mean, the political system in Britain is basically... it's way past its sell-by date. Hmm. It doesn't represent the views.
No,
so, for example, you've got UKIP. In other European countries, you'd already be motoring because people who voted UKIP wouldn't be undermining the existing Conservative vote. But you, of course, from a Labour Party point of view, I wish all power to your elbow in the Eastleigh by-election and all the rest of it because you're undermining the Conservatives. And we've got the same problem on the left. If we speak out against the people we're not happy with and we're running the Labour Party, we're undermining our own game. Mm. Now, that just forces politics into a tiny little narrow area.
Yep.
And we need to just change the system so that a variety of views can be heard. Because what happens with only certain people allowed to win is that the debate just becomes ridiculously narrow. We need to have a very wide-ranging debate about the future of our country in this situation. It's probably the worst crisis since the Second World War. We actually need a variety of voices to be heard and then coalitions to be formed, but we can't do it.
Martin, I mean, Mervyn King, the outgoing Governor of the Bank of England, actually said that looking at the financial statistics, we are going through a Second World War in terms of what's happening with our economy, that it's affecting, I mean, the economic crisis is affecting the economy in the same way as a world war could.
Well, I mean, the government has said that, yes. I mean, if it's a war, then really avoiding your taxes is more than just a bit cheeky, isn't it?
Hmm. Okay, on to our next story. NHS whistleblower was paid £500,000 to keep quiet over patient safety, and he breaks silence to expose a culture of fear. This was in the Telegraph a couple of days ago, yesterday in fact, I think. So Gary Walker, who was head of a hospital trust, has now been investigated over high death rates, claimed he raised concerns 4 years ago with the NHS chief executive, Sir David Nicholson. That's the chappie who was involved in Staffordshire as well, of course. Mr Walker said he prioritised scarce resources on emergency care despite pressure from above to meet targets on non-emergency treatment, whatever the demand. While he was chief executive of the United Lincolnshire Hospitals Trust, he claimed that on one occasion he was even ordered by a Strategic Health Authority boss, now a senior NHS official, to take hospitals off red alert status, meaning that they were too full to take any more patients because of a delicate budget meeting taking place at the time. Ben, you first on this. I mean, he's paid his money to leave as a settlement with the health service, but he was told, if you speak out about it, we're going to come take you to court and have all that money back off of you. And in fact, it may even affect your pension and this kind of thing. So it's a gagging clause. He's just decided to totally ignore it. Now, I think there's probably many, many people out there who wouldn't do that sort of thing. Mm. What does this tell us about the way the health service is going these days?
Again, I riddled with sort of back to front kind of people with no morals and who really don't care about too much other than money, I suppose. I mean, what I would say about the NHS is I am a massive advocate of the NHS, and I think that it is in a better place now than it was, say, 10 years ago. Much better. But obviously there are still things going on, such as this. I mean, my only question would be, he took the money in the first place. So I don't know why he had a change of heart, but I'm glad he did, because, you know, we need to know about these things. Because if we, you know, the NHS is an organisation that is going to constantly evolve and change, and it has to, just by its nature. And we need to know about this stuff, and people shouldn't be scared or worried about coming forward, you know.
But his argument is he had to take the money, otherwise he can't pay the mortgage, and he can't feed the kids, you know, because essentially when you're in this sort of situation,
yeah,
that's it, your career is over.
Yeah. I mean, from my experience in the Navy, it was very much like, you know, when you had to report to your managers or sort of officers or whatever, they just wanted to know that the paint was sort of freshly painted and there were no problems. And it seems that through every sort of organisation with large tiers of management, that's it. It's all about career progression, you know, people just wanting to hear the right things. They actually don't care, and really don't want to hear about anything that may be going wrong. And I'm, you know, that worries me.
Okay, how do you fix this kind of thing then?
Well,
you can have a think about that if you want.
I think I might have to think about it.
Well, we have a listen to Gary Walker now speaking on the radio yesterday.
One of the jobs of chief executives, and I've said that since I've become a chief executive, is that you need to act as an umbrella against the pressure that you're put under to deliver targets. You know, your priority is to run a safe organisation, not to just deliver targets. I'm saying that this pressure is applied throughout the whole of the NHS. It is quite sinister. Francis called it a kiss-up, kick-down culture, and that is exactly what it is. People brief up the line, all good news, and anything bad, they are kicked until they are kicked into submission or go away quietly or just shut up.
Martin, kiss up, kick down culture. All good news up at the board, and if you come up with any bad news at the board, you're going to get kicked.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the idea of having a commercial edge to decisions in the National Health Service was wrong in the first place when it was brought in by New Labour, because what New Labour had done is they bought into the idea that the public sector model was needed reforming in a more private sector direction, and they're forgetting that the purpose of the health service is to provide health. It's not to save money, and ultimately for example, the monopoly buying power of the health service is the way to keep costs down when you're dealing with drug companies and so on. There is a case for proper top-down planning. Now, proper top-down planning, like in the Navy or any military organisation, of course it's a hierarchy, of course there's a guy at the top, but you make doubly sure, if you can, that the information from the bottom is genuine and honest. Yeah, we are under attack. We know what's going on, and you've got to make proper assessments. And the National Health Service came out of the experience of the Second World War, which is we've got to have a plan. We can't just leave this to chance. And of course, that's what it, that's the whole basis of it, you know, the Blitz and so on. Now, what's happened is we've imported into the health service all of this, you know, provider purchaser split and all the rest of it, and this is the root of the problem. And we, ultimately, I think we're going to have to go back to thinking of it as a service rather than as a pretend supermarket.
But they're talking about it, I mean, from last week as well, as a culture which is now embedded in there. There are thousands of middle managers and senior managers who are absolutely with this culture, this what was called here the kiss-up, kick-down culture, which he was describing there as a sinister culture.
Well, I mean, we had a quote last week, a clip last week from somebody saying about mid-staffs that if you missed a financial target, you'd lose your job. But if people died on the ward, there was nothing said. Now, that's the wrong set of priorities for a health service.
So I suppose the sinister side of this is if someone dies in their bed, that's actually good because this is another free bed.
You said it. I guess that you could look at it and say that exactly that. Yeah, you know, that is a free bed and someone can go into it.
Pretty scary stuff. Okay.
It's just misconceived.
All right, so I did ask you at the beginning, Ben, what do we do to fix the NHS? Have you had a chance to think about...
Well, I guess so. I mean, you know, I think the clue is in the title. It's the National Health Service, you know, and I think the focus has got to be on positive outcomes, not money. And it should be transparent. And if people think that things are going wrong and it's all about people's care, then they should be able to say to the people that make these decisions that something is wrong. And I think it's terrible that that's not the case. And I think the only way you're going to make that happen is change. I guess the change the setup. It's not right that it is basically it's almost a private company now, or made up of lots of different private providers, which is a massive problem, like you say. And the trouble is, I think with the government's changes now, that's set to get worse. And it's almost like the government is setting the NHS up now to fail. And that is a massive, massive worry. But I guess the only way you can get rid of this stuff is transparency.
And would the Royal Navy work as a private business?
Absolutely not. No, no.
Can you imagine ships bidding to be sent into combat or not, depending upon how much they put into the tender.
I mean, it's incredible, you know. I mean, I left because I didn't like what it was becoming as a government body already, you know. God knows what it would be like if it was private. The A-team springs to mind.
The A-team, oh God, yeah. I mean, I suppose we're talking about Blackwater. I mean, they've got their own navy now, haven't they? Out down in Somalia, pirating... supposedly policing the pirates, and they're being paid by the government. It's a sort of subcontractor of NATO and the US. But anyway, that's a whole other can of worms there. One other thing to do with this story, though, is it's very important, I think, to focus on this idea of the gagging clause, because the National Health Service are not the only people that use gagging clauses. Bristol City Council uses gagging clauses. The BBC use gagging clauses when people leave the BBC. So there is something called the Public, I think it's called the Public Interest Disclosure Act, which actually says that you have that as a defence in court. If they come after you for the money, then after you've blown the whistle and after you've spoken out, in other words, breaking a gagging clause in an agreement that you've made when you've left somewhere, that you do have a defence. The problem, of course, being is that do people want to have that court battle, especially if that money is being paid like a pension or something over a longer period of time? All that happens is suddenly the money stops as soon as you speak out. Then you've got to go to court and fight it. Martin, is there any way around this, you know, to stop? Because the Health Select Committee this week said that this is wrong. They don't want any of these gagging clauses in these contracts.
Well, you've just given the answer to your own question.
Have I?
Yes, let's get these gagging clauses killed off.
Yeah, because, I mean, for example, the coroner in Bristol was sacked a couple of years ago. A gagging clause was written in by Stephen McNamara, the head of legal services, Bristol City Council, into that so that he couldn't then go to the press and explain why he'd been sacked and give his side of the story. I mean, I think that is one of the healing processes of anything that's gone wrong, is that people do need to be able to talk about it, Ben.
No, they do. And, you know, I think people generally, and right across the board, it can be anything, I think they're crying out for transparency now, you know. And with social media, with programs like this, people want to know and they're asking questions and people feed off of information. I think it's changed a little bit from the past now. People want to know what's going on, and I think, you know, they have every right to know as well. I'd quite like to know why the coroner did leave, actually.
Well, he was sacked. Well, he didn't actually leave. He was sacked because of a big dispute with the city council. Mm. What had happened was the coroner's services across the country, by law, are supposed to be totally independent. Mm. And yet what had happened 3 or 4 years previously is all the payroll for the coroner's service had been subsumed by the city council. So, you know, it was basically to do with whether, they could cut his pay off and therefore they can sack him. So that was how that whole thing transpired. Mm. I'm very much hoping that Paul Forrest, who's the former coroner, at some point in the future will be able to tell everybody his side of the story, because all we got was the official news story at the time was, the poor chap's been sacked, never mind. And there was a little bit of reporting from, I think, a procedure with the Justice Department, because he appealed, and he hasn't really been able to speak about it since, because he's under one of these gagging clauses too, so that's not the only one. Okay, many more stories to go to have a look through. Bristol Port boss David Ord, this week in the Post, is accused of using his influence as a Tory donor to sway David Cameron against the Severn barrage. Claims the boss of Bristol's Port used his position as a prominent Tory party donor to lobby the Prime Minister over plans for a barrage across the city have been dismissed. David Ord is a co-owner of Bristol Port, a vocal opponent of plans to build a £30 billion barrage from North Somerset to South Wales to harness energy from the Severn estuary. Martin, what are your thoughts about the rights and wrongs of the barrage and the way that the port owner has been influencing, it appears, and denials have been issued, the Prime Minister at the highest level as a Tory party donor to stop this barrage?
Well, I mean, the sort of back-scratching of donors demanding what they want is pretty much par for the course, really. It's what you expect to go on. And, of course, it shouldn't be going on, and we should be really more aware of these things than we are. And in relation to what we've previously been talking about, one of the real problems is that when private companies enter into contracts with the government, they're often commercially confidential because of commercial law. And that means that large amounts of public money may be committed to things, but we're not allowed to know what they're committed to because of commercial confidentiality. So when people talk about public-private partnerships, they're forgetting the legal minefield that puts you into, because that's one of the problems that we've got. And the barrage as a whole, it strikes me, I mean, I'm not a big expert on this thing, but I have to have environmentalists in here, but a lot of people are saying it's a big mega project and we ought to be looking at smaller things rather than just big stuff.
Well, they were talking about, for example, barrages across the Avon, parts of the Avon, and also possibly over in Cardiff, which would be a much smaller project. Yeah. Well, what are your thoughts about the nub of this, though, Ben? Is this one of the reasons that you left the Conservative Party, because of allegations of lobbying by rich people giving to the party and trying to use that to get some political influence, as is being alleged here?
It's rife. I mean, you know, this guy, I'm not sure what he does give to the party. Probably quite a lot, I would imagine. But, you know, because he does that, he feels that he's got like a bat phone, red link straight to the Prime Minister, and he can lobby on what he wants if it affects him. And it's rife, you know. When it comes to the barrage, like Martin, I'm not sure. I mean, I know that technology has changed a lot, and I know that there's lots of scope with this. And if you were to have something like this built here, I mean, the employment and the opportunities that opens up for this area are immense. I mean, it's massive. And I know that the benefits of this would be much better than the stupid little wind farms that they keep putting up everywhere, which, coincidentally, you get £50,000 to put it up, and then a £1,500 kickback every week. And funnily enough, you know, David Cameron's father-in-law's got some of those as well. But and Nick Clegg's wife, she does the legals for one of the big companies, I think, that do all the legals for these. But you know, it just goes to show that we're happy to sort of look at stupid little things whereby we can get subsidies paid off to our friends, mates, and ourselves. Yet we don't want to look at a big project properly, and then we're not looking at this properly. I mean, there's a few people that have sort of been banging the drum about it, but actually, I think this needs some joined up thinking, all the local authorities to come together, all the big players, and actually have a proper discussion about the pros and cons of a barrage.
Okay, on to our next story, and that is looking really back over the last few weeks at the Conservative Party's introduction, or at least, I mean, a free vote in the House of Commons over gay marriage. And Maria Morris has been out on the streets asking you what your thoughts are about this new law.
Is Cameron right or wrong to champion the cause of gay marriage?
I don't agree with it. I think that the civil partnership should be adequate. But I speak as a person who has no religion myself, so there's not a lot of logic in my reply.
I don't really agree with it. It doesn't sit right. Gay, I suppose at the end of the day, it doesn't hurt anybody, does it, really? I mean, if people want to get married, I suppose, and then get married. I think in the long term, it's just probably not a good thing. Especially, I mean, you give them the right to marry, then the next thing you know, they can have children. And I mean, how are these children going to end up?
From Germany.
There is an option to have a civil union, you call it in Germany. Mm-hmm. So it's not totally equal to a marriage between woman and man, but it's similar.
In Spain, it's possible to marry two gays, or no, two men.
Well, I'm Eastern Europe, so Romania. Depends. It's a religion thing. It's not okay, but there are people, it's a need. It's like they have it in their blood, so it's normal, it's natural. It's like a disease, so it's not something mental. So you can do nothing. It's in their nature, so we have to accept them.
I think you should be allowed, because it's a commitment financially and for commitment purposes as well. I think it's right that not every church has to have gay marriages in their church if they don't personally agree with it. I think it's a good way to meet in the middle, really.
In my opinion, maybe it's wrong. It just seems wrong. There was something in Paris about it. There was a bit of a backlash in Europe. I don't agree with it, but at the same time, I don't agree with necessarily persecuting homosexuals. But
is gay marriage compatible with the Christian church?
I don't believe it is, because of tradition, a long tradition. I don't agree with the church on many things, but I do agree with it on that it's for procreation of children. It just doesn't work for me. Men and women bring different aspects into a relationship, and I see no harm in letting that continue. That it's sufficient, in my view, that they can have a legal civil partnership.
No, it's not at all, is it? I don't know much about Christianity, even though I'm supposed to be a Christian. It's just not really allowed, is it? And it's just not normal, is it? It doesn't go with the faith, does it, really?
Absolutely not. For sure, it's not.
It's down to the priest, isn't it? I think some are and some aren't, and I don't think you're going to change their views, really. I think they're pretty set in their ways.
Why is Western society more accepting of homosexuality than Eastern society?
A lot of Eastern societies are rooted in tradition and religion more closely than our society, and I also think that they don't question their own possible lack of logic in that. They don't explore other options sufficiently.
Well, we could learn something from that, I think. Definitely. I mean, we've let ourselves go, so I'm all up for that. I mean, too right, we need to stricten up and tighten up and get the values right. Normal family values, you know, this is a husband and a wife, children, bring them up right, manners, just being good.
They are maybe more traditional, they live more traditional ways.
To those parts are not so much gay people that shows that are, for now they hide this thing, so maybe they don't have the guts to step up front to say that that's why I am, and you have to respect me because I'm a human being.
I think England's always been a forward thinker in everything. It has to set an example for the rest of the world, doesn't it? So I think we've always been the first to stick our leg out there and go in the pond and try and lead by example, really.
Okay, well, gay marriage. Personally, I don't have much of an opinion formed on this, and I think quite rightly, because I'm not so sure it's a massive issue or a massive debate that should be had. I mean, UKIP were the only party that were opposed to it, and that wasn't because they're opposed to gay marriage. They're basically opposed to this being unequal. I mean, you're essentially a heterosexual couple can't have a civil partnership, you know, so the system is still very unequal. And I must say, this isn't about David Cameron being proactive and revolutionary. This is EU legislation that's coming across and being forced upon this country.
You're quite right. Yes, Martin, quickly, very quickly.
I think most people are, even if they're opposed to gay marriage, are not opposed to it in such a way that they really care about it that much. And I think, ultimately, British people are pretty tolerant. And as long as they're not being bothered, they don't care what other people get up to. And that's the way of it.
OK, we've got a whole lot more after the news, including a very great success. The disabled person successfully suing ATOS after the news.
At bcfm.org.uk. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour.
Live.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, the horse meat scandal has escalated yet again.